Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Dyslexia Life Hacks Show. I'm your host, Matthew Head. In this episode, I'm talking to Ben Hurst, who's a racing driver from Canada. He's recently competed in a BMW M4 GT4 in the British GT Championship, as well as the Dubai 24 Hours. He's had the honour of driving for Aston Martin Academy, and also has experience in single-seaters ranging from Formula 4s to Formula 3s. Around his racing, he provides driver tuition, worked for quite prestigious car manufacturers doing filming work. Somehow, he's managed to fit in time to study a BA in Sports and Leisure Management. I will put a link to Ben's website in the show notes, which will be available at dyslexialifehacks.com. Welcome to the show, Ben.
Hi, thanks for having me.
No worries. I wanted to ask first, what's it like racing a 24-hour race? It seems like a grueling test.
It's a lot of fun. Because you're in a team, you kind of just focus on the 2 hours you're in the car.
Yeah.
You let your teammates take over and you try to get as much rest as you can. So your race is really each stint that you're in the car, and you save as much energy as you can outside. Whereas if you're in a shorter race and your teammates are driving, you're staying up to date with the engineers, knowing exactly what they want to do. But in a 24, they say, no, you go relax. We'll update you just before you get in the car. So it's grueling, but if you schedule yourself beforehand and make sure you have a plan going in, it's a lot of fun and really rewarding at the end.
Is it? Because that was in the BMW, wasn't it, the M4?
Yeah, so I've done the Dubai 24 in the BMW, and I also competed in the Citroën C1 24 earlier.
Yeah, just a bit different than like a 90 power Citroën versus what, 500 horsepower at the BMW?
Yeah, so I think we were maybe just over 500 that weekend, because you can change the horsepower on your USB stick in the car.
Oh, like you do, yeah.
What the series you're running in, which USB stick you get to put in the BMW.
Oh, I see. Well, yeah. Okay. What is more challenging, racing the Citroën or the BMW for 24 hours? Because they do feel really different. And in my mind, the BMW is harder because it's high-powered and a bit of an animal, but maybe that's not correct.
The Citroën was a bit more difficult. And for a few reasons, the BMW is so well engineered to make the driver's job easy. The concentration is quite high because you're moving a lot faster.
Yeah.
But the Citroën, you have six cars in a train. And if you miss a shift, if you don't take enough speed through a corner, you can get passed by three of them by the next corner. And you've got to fight your way back to the front. Whereas because there's more differences in the cars in the BMW, we were racing against Astons, McLarens. It spreads the field out a bit more. And then you kind of start battling again at the end of the race when everyone's strategies work themselves out.
Oh, I see. Yeah, I can see that actually. Yeah. Having watched a few single race series, they are nose to tail where they're sort of multi stuff.
Exactly. Further out. Exactly.
So one of the reasons you're obviously on is that you are like Lewis Hamilton, dyslexic as well as a racing driver. So how did you, or when did you find out in your life that you were actually dyslexic?
I think it was grade 3 back in Canada.
How old would you be then?
6, I think.
Oh, same age as when I found out.
Okay. So it was an English teacher who said, you know what, I think I was just kind of a little bit behind in reading. And I didn't really like reading anyways, but she said, no, I think we should, I just want to run some tests. And I got to play those games with the different shapes and all of that.
Yeah.
And at the end of it, I was mildly dyslexic, but I was a strong visual learner. So when it came to videos and everything, I learned really quickly. And when it came to reading, I wasn't as quick a learner. So it's something I've had to work quite hard on and writing, because I've done some writing for a magazine in the US as well. And that was a challenge for me, but I've always had my family to help me make sure everything sounds good and is the point that I'm trying to get across.
Yes, yes. Yeah, the supportive network always really helps. How is the Canadian school system with dyslexia? Did you get much? Because what, you early 20s, aren't you? So
yeah, so I'm 24. We did get much help. I had a tutor from when I found out for the next 3 or 4 years afterwards that my parents helped me with. And that really helped me more so get stuff in place to know how to learn better than me. And it was different strategies like that that really helped me move forward.
So is that a tutor separate to the school system that your parents arranged privately?
Yes, it was. I think we met once a week.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then specifically for dyslexic teaching, any particular strategies you felt really worked for you?
Not doing everything all at once. Like if you're reading a book, just break it up into smaller pieces.
Yeah.
Organization as well. Getting yourself sorted. That's something I've had to learn recently, to be honest, is get a notebook and write down what I need to learn. So with my racing, even after we go out for a session, I sit down with my notebook and write what the weather was, what tires I was on, and what fuel load. And then I write down anything I want to talk about to the engineer with right away. And I don't forget it later on.
Yes, yes.
That's something that's translated well into my racing. Of having a notebook and writing stuff down as I remember it and going from there.
I must admit, I do the same. I've always got an open notebook on the right-hand side of my desk with a pen sat on it.
Yeah.
I know what you mean, because I imagine, particularly racing with a high-pressure environment, coming to pitch and your engineer wants to go, right, what was right wrong with the car? How can we get it go faster? Tell me this.
Exactly.
And you're like, really overwhelmed.
Yeah, so that was something that took me a while. One of my engineers in Canada had a driver who had one of his buttons on his steering wheel as a marker button for data.
Yes.
And if he had a massive oversteer or a moment during the lap, he would press the marker button and they would go back through the data. And I've never set that up on one of mine, but I've always kept that in my head. And I can see where I've made the mistake in the data now, because I'll know what other stuff happened on that lap. I try to remember. And then you can find out like what cars overtook me almost a reference point of where to look.
Yeah. Triumph did a similar thing whenever we had a tester out on a bike. If he got, because we're in prototype bikes. So you can imagine prototype engine mapping is entertaining sometimes.
Yeah.
He would flash the headlights or toot the horn, and you'd have that track in the data system. And when the spike goes up, right, something went wrong there. Let's have a look.
That's actually really good. I never thought to flash the headlights. When I raced in British Formula 3, we weren't allowed to change any buttons on the steering wheel.
Yeah.
And same with Aston and BMW. They were fixed to the regulations.
Mm-hmm.
It would actually be quite a good idea to flash the headlights or something, because you can always see a switch go on the data.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you just get a flat trace with a spike in it, and then the
exactly.
way it goes. There you go. So how did you get started in racing? Because if you had picked up dyslexia at 6, did you get started in racing at a similar time?
No, I started a lot later than most people do. I started when I was 16.
Oh, okay.
So I was desperate to start racing. As a birthday present one year, my dad got me a racing school course.
Nice.
Canada. And it was a 3-day course. And at the end of it, you got your racing license. And we had a race at the end and I finished second. But we were racing the instructors, and the instructors blocked me from racing the guy who won. So I was close to winning, but always close to winning. So from then I met another team back in Canada who wanted me to join them. And I won Rookie of the Year in my first season.
Oh, wow.
From there, 2 years later, I was the champion in Canada and won a scholarship to race in the UK at the Formula Ford Festival at Brands Hatch.
Oh, nice. Yeah, yeah.
So qualified 6th. And then I was taken out in the race, a car on the second lap. I think I made it into the final. But in that event, it's all about making it to the final. It's so tough. There was 75 or 80 cars.
Wow.
Eight spots in the final.
And Brands actually ain't a big track to put a formula for any car around this.
No, it isn't.
It's just places.
No, it really isn't.
80 cars. Wow, that's impressive. How do you, like, you've mentioned about your sort of dyslexia at school and stuff. Did yours particularly manifest in any certain way? You did touch on writing articles and reading and organizational skills.
Yeah, that's how it affects me the most, is especially reading. My mum would say I've always been a horrible reader. It's having the patience to sit down and do it because it takes me so long. I get frustrated. And other kids in class or even my sister loves reading. And it's like, yeah, I've just finished this giant book in 3 days. And I'm like, I'd be nowhere in 3 days.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I know that feeling. Did you find a particular subject you were really into, though? Like, for myself, I'd struggle with English, but directly we got into science, particularly when it got to mechanical things, I'd be away with the races.
That's very similar with me. If it was something I was interested in, it was like a switch turns on and I was night and day and it went really well. If it was something I struggled with and I wasn't interested in, it was really difficult.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Definitely engineering is where I get very interested. My math wasn't up to what it needed to be to get into engineering university. But also as racing driver, most drivers go to engineering so they can work on the car. But I've learned how to set up the car and everything through my racing. But the business side of it is what a lot of drivers struggled with. So that's why I did management and leadership and leisure, which it was called sports management originally, and they changed the name partway through my program. So it worked out really well because I worked at the Renault Formula One factory in the sponsorship department, and they've taught me how to go about ways of getting sponsors.
Okay, because I was going to ask you about that, because in my mind, at your level with the racing, you're kind of a self-employed driver. So what is the business of being a racing driver like?
At the moment with COVID, it's not great.
No.
There's no excess marketing budgets or anything to go around for drivers. So that's the reason I'm not racing this year, is getting the sponsorship is usually difficult, but in this climate, it's even more difficult. But you really have to sort, it's all about making connections and you've got to sort it out on your own. So you can go to a team and say, I want to race for you. And if they like you and you've got the right license, you're a good driver, they'll take you on. But then you've got to find the sponsorship to get that paid for, really, at the end of the day.
So you're bringing money into the team, or is that sponsorship so you can live?
You can do both. So yeah. I know drivers who bring some money into the team, but they keep working at their sponsorship and can earn themselves a salary as well out of it.
Okay, I see. So you're effectively not having to pay to drive the car, but you're not being paid to drive the car.
Exactly. And that's most racing drivers at the moment.
Yeah. Yes. But unless you're in the sort of top level sports on the team.
Exactly. In a Porsche factory seat or F1, or all the money's right at that top
level. Yeah. Yeah. Because I understand even like a touring car driver is not necessarily paid unless they're the top factory drivers.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's a difficult business that way. And if you can find a driver who likes you and has a huge budget, they're willing to pay other way as well. So either someone just starting out with a really big budget, they'll have you as their teammate and they pay for the racing and your way up with them.
Oh, okay. Oh, I see. So that they got the money and the resources, but they really want you as a teammate, because ultimately you're all competitive animals and want to win everything, don't you?
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. That's kind of curious. And so you're effectively almost like an entrepreneur, but your product is your ability to drive cars fast.
Exactly. Exactly. So that's why I do a lot of coaching on the side and as much work with manufacturers as I can, because that pays the bills. And I do not my racing on the side, because it's still the sole focus, but racing in between all of my other work.
Yes. And do you find being dyslexic helps you as a businessman?
It does, and it doesn't. It's it's difficult when you've got to word emails and everything perfectly, get to a sponsor to get them interested in you, because you're selling yourself.
Yes.
And that's something I've had to work very hard on, and I think a lot of people do, because it's not easy to sell yourself at the end of the day.
No. I don't even know where you start sometimes, but especially if you don't want to write things down and trying to write a story about yourself.
Exactly. Yeah. So I've done my own website and everything.
Yes.
And that took quite a while, actually, to get everything exactly how I wanted it to sound and to look.
No, I've had a look through your website and it's very slick with a kind of nice bio yourself and, you know, loads of, and it does look right. It looks really professional. I was like, wow, this guy clearly knows what he's doing if he's made the website. So,
thank you.
Obviously, you took your BA. Did you get much support during university, or what sort of tools did you use at university to study?
There was support available. I had extra time on my exam.
Yeah.
If needed. And I always had access to help with lectures if needed as well. I find with extra time on an exam, I don't like sitting there longer than I have to anyways. So I end up getting it done quite quickly, but it's nice to know if you start to struggle, you do have that. I think it's an extra hour you get.
An extra hour?
Wow. Yeah, so it was a 3-hour exam.
Ah, right. Yes.
Okay. So you get an extra hour.
Oh, God. What do you... Because you went to University of Manchester, didn't you?
Yes.
So you studied in the UK. What is the 3 hours long?
There was a lot of writing. It was... I can't remember which course it was, but it was effectively two essays in an exam.
Oh, I see. Okay. And did you not use scribes or anything? You actually wrote them yourself?
I did write them myself, but we actually, that was another thing we got, was we got to use them on the laptop.
Yes.
We have a system that basically you log in on one of the school computers and it's just the Word document that's open and you can't access the internet. You can't access anything else on the computer. It's just the Word document. So it worked quite well. And it was much quicker for me to type than it would have been to handwrite everything.
Oh, most definitely. Yeah. I never used laptops in exams at university because I got scribes and dictated the exam effectively when I had to do one like that.
But okay.
I'm curious to know, the laptop's got Word and obviously completely off the grid. Does it have any specialist software? Because you would have got DSA, wouldn't you?
I'm not too sure what that is.
I can't remember what the acronym is, but it's basically the allowance for people with dyslexia or any learning preference. So I had it, and you get it's where you get accessory, you get extra time, but they also give you laptops with software on it, and it pays for the scribes and all that kind of stuff.
Okay.
Might be different because you're Canadian coming over. I'm not quite sure on the sort of nuances of it.
I think it might have been different. So I did get the laptop, I think, had spell check on it as well. It had spell check. Well, spell check was active on Word.
Okay, yes. It is the standard Microsoft package. You couldn't use Dragon in that exam hall anyway. It would have been funny, wouldn't it? Yelling your exam out to the rest of the hall and then right, oh, that's a better answer. Hang on. Do you sit at the back and think it's quite funny when you open the laptop screen and everybody else puts their head down to a bit of paper with a pen?
It was a separate room, actually.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
I had this vision of being stood at the front of the room and there's all these people with paper and there you are with a laptop screen.
Typing away.
I'm not on Google Honest. That's cool. I can't totally understand where you're coming from. Having the management degree allows you to be better at the business of racing driver. The engineering degree, I guess, allows you to be better at understanding the car, which, being an engineer myself, I get that. Let's have a look at how you think dyslexia may help you driving a few famous racing drivers, dyslexic, Jackie Stewart and Lewis Hamilton being F1 drivers. Jackie always mentioned he felt like he was ahead of the car, and like his brain was already in the turn, even though he hadn't got there yet.
Yeah.
So how do you feel it comes up yourself?
I think I'm able to apply what we speak about and different techniques, especially when we're looking through data. I'm able to apply that quite well to my driving. And I think Jackie Stewart also has incredible hand-eye coordination.
Mm.
And I think that's also part of it, is that's where I'm quite good of, I can look at the data, and if I see it visually, of no, you need to be on the throttle just a little bit earlier than the next lap you look at, that you've gone out and fixed it, and it's fixed and it's exactly where it needed to be. Or we need a little bit more pressure on the brakes. And you're not talking big changes, but I'm able to do those little details. And I've seen some other drivers have a bit more trouble with that. So I think that could be also why I've done so well learning it since I was 16 and I didn't go kart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because that's not the normal route to start late to not race go-karts, is it? Everybody
exactly
cuts their teeth at go-karting normally.
Exactly.
So just walk me through it. So, but I'm a big motor racing fan, but for people who are not into motor racing, I kind of totally understand what you're talking about, but you'll come back in the pits after a race session.
Yep.
Out the car, the race engineer's got all the telemetry up on the screen, and then you're having like a coaching session almost of, in terms of...
Yeah, so the engineer's there to make sure the car is running at its optimum, and that includes the setup and how the tires are being used, and including how the brakes are used, how the throttle is applied and everything. So it's a coaching session, but it's specific to what's going on that day.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got the reference laps of data of a driver who's done it really well, aspects of laps that are done really well, and you compare your own telemetry to data that they have that is doing either a specific corner better or the whole lap better, and you can build on it from there. So we'll look at the throttle, the brake, and the speed of the car and work on getting it to the best that it can and as quick as possible through the lap, but also saving brakes and tires as well. And if it's a 24-hour race, saving petrol.
Yes. Yeah, there's actually... I used to think it was about aggressive pushing, but and this is only from my experience of messing around with motorbikes and doing go-karting as a sort of leisure activity. But actually, the more finesse you have with it and the more delicate you are with the vehicle,
exactly,
it gets quicker. It's a really weird dichotomy to this big, loud thing that's going at hundreds of miles an hour. It's this gentle kind of thing through the vents.
You're very gentle with the car. Some cars you have to be really aggressive with to get the lap time out of. When you're at the level of the BMW and the Aston, it's quite gentle, really, compared to what you think it would be. Because if you start to drive too late into the corner, brake really, really late, you've got all the weight on the nose, you get the car turned, but then you can't get the power down, and you're using up your front tires to get the car turned, and the back end starts stepping out on you, and you may be feeling like you're flying because the car's drifting and all over the place. But really, you back it up just a little bit, 1 or 2 meters, the car is going to be flat all the way through the corner, and you'll be accelerating out, and you'll actually have gained a big chunk of time than braking as late as possible.
Yes, yeah. I guess the drifting one looks good in the photos, though.
Oh, it looks great.
I'm a hero. I'm 4 seconds off the pace. Yeah.
Exactly.
So you're saying about you talking to the telemetry with your engineer, and he picks up points. We're taking example of you're not picking the throttle up early enough out the corner.
Yeah.
So you're saying you think the way your brain works with being dyslexic and being more of a picture thinker and a visual person.
Yeah.
I'm sort of envisioning now that you're going down, I don't know, say the hanging straight Silverstone, just throwing it into Stowe Corner. Are you seeing that telemetry in your mind's eye as you're going around a corner, and or are you the other way around, where you're looking at the telemetry and visualizing where that corner is before you go back out on track?
I think I can see the telemetry more than looking at the data and seeing what I'm doing on track. Because if it's Stowe's a really good example of breaking slightly earlier, you can almost see your reference points and you're seeing the peak on the brakes when you hit it, backing off and then turning in and then waiting to go on the throttle because you've carried enough speed. I can see that whole transition and what it needs to be as I'm doing it.
Yeah, that's cool. So you kind of have it sort of visually floating around in your sort of field of vision almost, but even though it's not actually there.
Yeah.
That's a great sort of example, I think. And I do it very similar things with in other ways. That you can just see the stuff floating around in front of you. But
yeah,
interesting. So you go out. Okay, I guess because you're now a trained racing driver, you don't have to just do one corner. But you go out, right, I want to go here. And you can bring the data up, right? We just need to get on it there.
Yeah. Well, a good way I started was picking three things to fix.
Yes.
In a session. So you go out and first session in the morning, if it's your first time at the track, just try and learn the track.
Mm-hmm.
You need to do is just figure your way around. And then when you come in and look at the data, don't do everything all at once. A bit like what I was saying earlier with reading, just go, where's my biggest loss on the lap? And then second biggest and third biggest and fix it from there. And if you get those better, then go to the next three spots. So you're not concentrating on the whole lap and you're not overwhelmed at each corner trying to work on something.
Yes. Yeah, that makes sense. Break it down. It's like any big problem, it needs to be
overwhelmed. Exactly.
Do you find with the analogy of seeing the data and getting on earlier? I mean, I'm thinking maybe somebody who's not a visual learner has to go out and try three or four different sort of throttle on points and then come back and check his data and see where they are.
Yeah.
And then go back out. Well, you can almost iterate live on the track as you're doing laps.
I always try different stuff, see what works, because you might find a better way of doing it. You might find you most likely will find a worse way of doing it. So I always try two or three things to see if it works and then look at the data and you can compare each of those laps with each other. Okay, that was actually, it might not have been a better lap in general, but what you did there actually worked quite well.
Yeah. Because you now do tuition. So how are you finding, because you seem quite good at explaining what's going on with the car. That's, to me, seems like a dyslexia thing as well. Do you find that really helps when you're teaching other people how to drive fast?
I do. So I also taught skiing in high school.
Okay.
And that kind of started off me trying to explain how the skis worked. When you start teaching adults, they're scared. But if you teach them how the ski actually works and how, you will stop, you're edging really, really, really hard. And it's like, oh, okay, that actually makes sense now. And that kind of I've been able to translate into coaching and racing of, just explain how the car works a little bit. And then it's not overwhelming then when they're driving. And you see a lot of people braking really, really late.
Yeah.
Because they think that's the best way to go quicker.
almost
every car I'm in, that's where they start. And it's, if you think of the car as scales, you need to dip the weight forward, get it turned, and then get the weight on the rear. And if you're at the apex still, full lock, understeering, you've gone in too hot.
That's a very good analogy of the weight transfer. It's so tempting. Like, I just need to brake later and later and later until the ABS is on and the tires are squealing at you.
Exactly. I had one recently and I said, you've got to just keep a little bit of brake pressure on all the way into that apex, because it was an M2. And those, if you keep just a little bit of brake pressure on, it keeps the front exactly where you want it.
And
you roll off of it and you can build the throttle and you can get the car turned better and get to throttle sooner. But they were obviously nervous about keeping a bit of brake on, because if you're braking late like he was, you will spin because all the weight's forward. And it's an unnatural thing to want to do, is break into the corner if you're breaking that hard and that late.
Yes, because I suppose back to your scale analogy, he or she is breaking with 90% on the front scale. Well, actually, it needs to be more like 60 to be able to trail exactly. break to the apex.
Exactly.
Yeah. Now that's, I like the scale analogy. I've seen various versions of it, but that's really kind of quite a nice visual way of describing how the car's working underneath people.
Exactly. And I think that's where I'm able to describe it from my dyslexia, because you have to visualize it somehow.
Yes. Yes. Do you find people, it works a lot better with people when they do see the visual kind of analogy?
Usually, every person's different.
Of course, yeah.
You get a feel with how they learn, and you can go from there. Some people, if you have a piece of paper, you can write down, like, you've got 100, like a grips square, and you've got 25% grip.
Mm.
We break, it goes to the front and to the back. Some people, you can describe it or tilt your helmet as you're sitting there talking forward and back, and that works. But every person's different. So
yeah.
I think because I know how I learn, I'm more sympathetic to figuring out how they learn and working with them.
Do you think that comes from the extra tuition and the struggle you initially had at school that you had to work out strategies?
I think so. I actually am quite lucky, and I know exactly how I learn. And I think we can learn things quicker because it's watching video, I'll learn a track quicker. I know that. Or some people do the pictures of each corner entry, corner apex, corner exit, or data. And those are three ways to learn a track. But I know that the video is the one for me to go to.
Nice. Yes. And is that what you did at school and university as well? You use videos to help you with things.
Yeah, usually. So if there was a book that we had to read for English class that had a movie, I'd look what the differences were. I watched the movie, and I usually did pretty well on the test because I knew what to avoid that wasn't in the book.
Yes.
And go from there.
Yeah, I could imagine that would get you in lots of trouble with certain
books
to movie adaptations. I'm just thinking about Without Remorse. It's nothing like the book at all.
That's why you always have to look it up first.
Yes. Yeah, or you're in for 3 hours with The Hobbit.
Exactly.
Where did this come from? Yeah. <And that's, laughs> I do a very similar thing. I was the same at uni. If I was struggling for maths or something, I'd use like Khan's Academy or various YouTube sites that would have them doing the equations live on video, and that kind of helped.
YouTube's great for that.
Yeah, it's brilliant. Yes. Yeah, it certainly is. Do you find you use audiobooks as well for consuming information?
I was traveling around the UK a lot in university for racing and for training. But I couldn't drive. So I listened to audiobooks quite a lot while I was on the train. And I felt they were really useful, and it was books that I wanted to read or that my dad would say were really good, but now they're available as audiobooks. I listened to them and I really enjoyed them, actually.
Yes. Yeah. You've already touched on not being a fan of consuming major novels in written form, I suppose.
Yeah,
a lifesaver for that.
Yeah.
You also have to drive quite a few different cars, I imagine. If you're doing coaching for various different track days, then racing a GT car at the weekend, and then maybe going to whoever car manufacturers do some high speed work.
Yeah.
How do you find the switch between it? And does your visual skills help you with that?
I think so. I think that every car is different.
Yeah.
But my passion is cars. I like to have a basic understanding of all cars that I could be in. So when I go to a track day to coach, I'll know that a McLaren's electronics are very, very good. And you can teach your customer to kind of work with them. Whereas a BMW, it likes you to drive the car more than the electronics will let you. Because they don't really interfere that much, especially in MDM mode. They're backed off quite a lot. So you've got to make sure you're driving it very, very well.
Oh, I see.
Each car is so different in that aspect, but if I have a basic understanding of what they're doing, then you can help coach a lot better.
Yeah, so I see what you mean. So, well, the example of the McLaren, because it catches you, is the best way of extracting a good lap time out of it, basically driving it into the electronics and letting it catch everything and sort of driving on the traction control all the time.
Yeah, so it's standard mode on traction control is you can put your foot down if you've got lock on.
Yeah.
And straighten the steering wheel, it accelerates out of the corner.
Oh, wow. Would a BMW have you in the gravel trap at high speed?
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah. So, but as you know that and you're sitting in the passenger seat, you can give them different instructions, but you have to know it's different instructions.
Yes. Yeah, so you have to tailor it not only to the driver's learning style, but what the car lets them get away with.
Exactly.
Do you find a particular type of personality is better or worse at the kind of tuition stuff in terms of you giving them coaching?
Someone who's willing to learn.
Yeah, yeah.
Always best. You get the odd one. There isn't too many because they're all paying for a track day and be there that think they know better. And that doesn't happen often. I've only met a handful like that.
Mm.
But if they're starting to challenge you on what you're saying, you can't learn like that. You always have to have an open mind and I want to get better at this. And that's where it gets challenging. But as long as someone's willing to learn, we have a great day and they always improve.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Coming with an open mind and willing to learn is a growth mindset.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly.
That's cool. It's really interesting in the difference between the car. And I imagine being the visual person that you are, do you just consume a few YouTube videos and reviews on the car you've got of the day, particularly if it's not one you're familiar with, and you kind of feel ready to go?
Yes. So I usually like to stay up to date with it anyways.
Yeah. Yeah.
About the car this week. But if it's something that I really haven't been in before, then I make sure I know. I watch some YouTube reviews. I make sure I know everything I can about it before I go. Because like you said, you prepared for the day then. No surprises. You're good to go.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you drive the car there? Because it's their personal car, isn't it? So that you...
Depends on where I work. Sometimes it's a racing school's car.
Okay. And
sometimes it's their own car. I typically don't like to drive. Unless they're really struggling with the racing line, I don't like to drive for them. But that's my policy. Some drivers just get in and show them a lap. But I'd rather them show me where they are and we work from there.
No, I could see that. How do you sort of take the... I'm trying to work out, because the feedback, like myself driving a car, and I've thrown an M4 out of track at Brands Hatch once, that it's all the bum and the hands are telling you what's going on, but you're now in the passenger side, strapped in with somebody else driving it. How do you feel where on the limit and where they're not, and how's the car communicating to you so you can communicate it back to them?
If they're a beginner,
yeah,
I speak of like, okay, brake now, turn in gently on the power or aggressively on the power or whatever, and if they're listening to me, it feels like I'm driving the car.
Ah, cool. Okay.
So I can feel exactly what it's doing. And it's really great when you have a customer that's listening so closely and you can say, okay, brake off the brakes, into the corner, smooth on the power. And literally everything you do, they do, or you say they do. And it's like you're driving the car. So I don't find it too difficult to feel what the car is doing in the passenger seat. Once we get communication worked out between us, it's no problem.
Okay. No, that's cool. And you don't find any problem swapping from one side of the car to the other?
No. Occasionally, it takes a second to rewire.
Yeah, yeah.
Because being Canadian, I've driven on the left.
Of course, yes.
So it actually feels more natural for me to be on that side of the car anyways.
But yeah.
Cars are on the left, even if they're in the UK. So when I go to the right, it's like, okay, no, I'm on the other side of the car now. And it's like a 30-second adjustment, but it is an adjustment.
Yes. Yeah. I just thought that's fine. You've learned the track and visualized yourself with the car in a certain position and you get thrown to the other side of it. And you're like, huh?
Well, then when I did open wheel, you're in the middle of the car.
Yes. Yeah. Oh.
So it's, they're all different.
So back to some of the track learning things. If you were learning a track cold, it was a new track that had been made before, but you have a few videos of it from like a course car that's not even up to speed. So you sort of watch the layout and you know you're going to drive, say, your BMW, a car you're familiar with at circuit. Do you find that you can sit there and visualize driving the car around to kind of
get up? Yeah, it typically takes me 3 laps once I'm actually on track.
Okay.
But I can, you are visualizing it all the time of corners you're struggling or areas you want to make sure you know by the time you get there. Say, Maggots and Beckett's at Silverstone before I got there. So high speed, you want to make sure you're familiar with it before you go. So you watch videos of maybe specifically that section and then you visualize it until you're actually there in person. And a track walk's a good way to do that as well on a race weekend. You can see the different curbs, you can see different breaks in the pavement, different seams, and those are all your reference points for then when you're in the car.
And do you find your visual learning skills, you're almost stood on the track walk visualizing yourself in the car at that point?
Yeah. And you're looking, okay, that bump might upset the car. So, but you know what your car is capable of as well. So you can almost picture it of, no, I know that you may want to brake before that bump and just let, if it's a GT car, let the ABS take over. So that's where you kind of have to know your car really well and on the track walk, visualize what it's going to do.
Yeah, no, I can see that. I think it's certainly a huge advantage of being a picture thinker and having all them pictures in your head, because you must go into Maggots and Beckett's and say there's a bump partway through it. That bump picture that you've already seen on the track, what comes up as a bump here, and I'll just roll the brakes or whatever.
Exactly. Sometimes if the pavement's smooth,
yep,
you're, say, in the F3 car, you find bumps when you get out there that you could have seen.
It's super sensitive, yeah.
Exactly, but that's only with the really, really sensitive F3 car.
Yeah. I bet they're a different weapon altogether. And I bet the Citroens don't worry about it at all, do they?
No, you can go over any curb you want.
One thing I thought was really interesting, I was looking at the 24-hour racing, and I find I am, quote-unquote, more dyslexic when I'm tired versus, you know, fully awake and during the day. And I was thinking, if you're in the middle of a 24-hour race, you're out in the car for 2 hours and you've had a little bit of a nap, but you're not doing a full 8 hours sleep, are you? And it's the middle of the night. How do you kind of, does it affect you when you're tired at all, particularly when you're in the car in a 24-hour situation?
It hasn't yet. I think you're so focused on what you're doing. It's more instinct as well, kicking in. I'm always up late anyways. I like nighttime effectively. So nighttime really worked well for me in a 24. I liked the dark and I just enjoyed it. Some drivers don't, some drivers do, but I loved it. And then early morning is when I would have a nap. Like you said, it's not a full 8 hours. It's maybe 2. And then you're back up and ready to go. But I didn't find it's affected me.
No, that's cool.
Yeah.
Because I actually saw on your profile that you have experience of racing in the dark, in the rain, on a track that's not lit up. Now,
yeah,
that sounds mad.
It was fun.
What, in a 500 horsepower car?
Yeah. And that's when you really have to make sure you know what the car is going to do, because you can't see your reference points. They're all gone.
Yeah.
Different ones for the night, and you're just looking at the track ahead.
Okay. Does the visual thing help you with that? Because you've already got the visual picture.
Probably. Definitely, because you already know kind of where you're going. You know where you are on the track. You know what's next.
Yeah. I can see that. You're almost putting the pictures, in my analogy, you're almost putting the pictures of the track you know from the day in to fill in all the blanks that you can't see with the rain on the screen.
Yeah.
That's No, that's quite interesting. I wonder how many racing drivers are actually dyslexic, because a lot of big names are, but I wonder how many through the ranks.
I'm sure a lot are, and it's just they've not been, it's not been found.
Yeah, because it's always a joke sometimes that, you know, they got so focused on racing that they didn't necessarily stick at school. But I wonder if it's actually a frustration of school not working for them and them loving racing and being drawn to that. Been interesting to look into. So it's great that Lewis and Jackie do some advocacy for it. I've seen Lewis put stuff up about it recently. So that's brilliant. What I'm going to do, I'm going to start winding it down to, I've got a few rapid fire questions I'd like to finish.
Sounds good.
They don't need quick answers from you, but they're quick questions from me. So the first one is, what prejudice have you had about dyslexia that has been proven wrong?
That's a good question. I'm really not too sure. I've never thought about it in a negative way. So I tried not to let it get to me. So I honestly am not sure which, if any, if I've probably, there has been, but I don't really remember, if that makes sense.
I think you're a shining example of, and you know, hats off to your parents, getting the right tuition in at the right time to help you with it, to not get any of the kind of emotional stuff about it, I think.
Yeah. No, it's frustrating because it shouldn't be an issue.
Yes, I completely agree.
It really shouldn't. So it's frustrating when you see people who have had a tough time with it.
Yeah, it's such a shame. It's the language is now changing, but it's got a long way to go. But it is. You do sound like a really good example of getting the right things in early.
Yeah, no, my parents did a good job with all of that.
Yeah, that's okay. The next question is: if an alien came down, how would you describe dyslexia to them?
Thinking differently,
And
conventional thinking is probably a good description, because we just do think differently. And I think that's why you see some are really, really successful. Quite a lot are.
Yeah, I agree. There's more and more successful dyslexics coming out of the woodwork every day.
Exactly.
It feels like now, doesn't it? It's really nice to see it.
Yeah.
It's really inspirational for everybody. And my last question, considering this is the Dyslexia Life Hacks show, do you have any dyslexia life hacks?
A notebook.
Yes.
Yeah, definitely my notebook for everything.
Is it always by your side, clutching onto it?
Always in my backpack.
Do you have this is me geeking out here. I always have a notebook and a Parker jotter because it's just the pen I like using. Do you have like a particular pen with it?
I have a Porsche pen that I used. I got it when I worked at Porsche. Always in my backpack as well.
Show off, Porsche pen.
It's the cheap ones, just plastic and Porsche down the side.
No, it's funny how you get little routines like that. Certain type of notepad, like, this notepad's brilliant, and then a pen to go with it.
Exactly.
Is there anything else you'd like to add, or where can people find you if they want to find you?
Instagram, my website. Anyone wants to have a chat or anything, just send me a message.
No problem. I will link them in the show notes, which will be available at Dyslexia Life Hacks. And I want to thank you very much for taking the time to talk to me. It's been really interesting. And I think I've had a bit of fun talking about racing and some of you, which is always good fun.
Me too. Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. And thank you, everybody else, for taking the time to listen. I will see you in the next episode. Goodbye.